Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. Last week, the Attorney General announced 13 felony charges against former State House Speaker Lee Chatfield in relation to allegedly using state, campaign, and nonprofit funds for self-enrichment. Today, MERS speaks with legal professional Jessica Bartlett on what exactly are 501c4 and 527 nonprofits and why it's rare for states to pursue charges involving them. Also, Executive Director Brittany Affolter Kane of the University Research Corridor discusses analysis finding that the state's three major research universities spent more than $1.1 billion in Michigan on goods and services across three fiscal years. Michael Lamo, the Director of Environmental and Energy Affairs for the Michigan Chamber of Commerce, describes his organization's concerns surrounding new federal pollution standards for automobiles. Now here's MERS podcast host Samantha Schreiber and editor Kyle Malin.
Thank you so much, Mark Bayshore, for warming up today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. To begin things, we are going to be discussing some big headlines that came out of Lansing last week, which are felony charges made by Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel against the past Speaker of the State House, Emmett County Republican Lee Chatfield, and his wife. The charges are related to what the Attorney General's office describes as, quote, orchestrating a scheme of self-enrichment against state, campaign, and nonprofit funds, end quote. They allege the misuse of the 501c4 Peninsula Fund nonprofit, two electoral political action committees, and seeking improper mileage reimbursements from the State House for District to Lansing travel that never actually took place. Ways the money was allegedly spent include reimbursing a trip to the Bahamas with staff and friends in December 2018, a family vacation to Florida, a downtown Lansing apartment he then subleased and pocketed the money, and other things under the scope of luxury shopping, fine dining, and nice hotels. With all of that being said, we are, for our opening segment, going to be joined by Jessica Bartlett of the Political Law Practice Group within Dickinson Wright's Washington, D.C. office. She's a legal advisor on political committees, nonprofit, and donors, and is particularly a legal expert on rules governing gifts and ethics in tax-exempted organizations. She recently worked as general counsel on the 2023 Ron DeSantis for President campaign. First off, thank you so much for joining us via Zoom, Jessica. How are you doing today?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing great. So I know that you can't speak on this case specifically at this particular moment in time, but I would really like to poke your mind on, for beginners, how would you describe what a 501c4 is, and how have you seen them get misused before in the past?
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here. A 501c4 is what's called a social welfare organization. And that means that it's organized and operated primarily to promote social welfare. So literally, that means that it needs to spend more than 50% of its time and its resources on activity that the IRS considers to be social welfare activity. So what does that look like? Generally, that can include anything that a C3 would do, so charitable activity, and can even include some lobbying or public persuasion activities. Additionally, a C4, which makes it distinct from a 501c3, it can engage in a limited amount of political activity, as long as political activity is not the primary purpose of the organization. So again, this literally means less than 50% of the organization's time and resources can be spent on political activity. Now, the tricky part is, how do you define political activity? And that is where organizations that are organized and operated under Section 501c4 need help from lawyers, because the IRS uses this very amorphous facts and circumstances test to determine whether activity is political or whether it should be considered social welfare.
Can you spend money through a 501c4 to raise money for the 501c4?
Absolutely. So 501c4s, like any organization or any company, in order to be able to do their work and to promote social welfare or even engage in political activity, need to raise funds. And so, yes, you can spend money to raise money. That's called fundraising. And there's a line for it on the 990.
Is there a limit to how much you can spend from your 501c4 for fundraising purposes?
You know, there's not necessarily a limit. Generally, we think that fundraising is considered an operational expense. And whenever you're looking at a healthy nonprofit organization, you want to keep your operational expenses low, generally under 10 to 15% if the organization is established and has been around for a while. Organizations that are just getting started, they may be spending more money on fundraising because they need to do it and get into the swing of things, but there is not necessarily a limit.
So what about, I wanted to ask about personal items then. What happens when somebody spends things out of this 501c4 for arguably personal purposes, just hypothetically speaking, going to Universal Studios or buying something from the snack shop or the concession stand? Is that allowed, I should say? And then what happens when somebody does do that?
It's interesting how you framed the question. I think if it's purely for personal purposes, obviously you shouldn't be using a 501c4 to cover that. If it's part of a fundraising purpose, so for example, if there is a fundraising event held, you know, at Universal Studios, I've seen clients do this before where they'll do it over spring break, they'll do a retreat, they'll invite the whole family, and it's a good way to get participation, then, you know, you possibly could pay for those types of expenses through a 501c4 if it truly is for a fundraising purpose.
Could you give us some examples of a time where maybe a client was like, okay, I think I might use my 501c4 for this, but I don't know if I should. And it can be hypothetical too, but what are some cases you can think of where the use of a 501c4 gets a little weird, a little wonky?
You know, typically, Samantha, whenever I have clients that come to me who want to set up a 501c4, they really want to do something good. They have a social welfare purpose for this. And they do come to us with questions. I mean, I think an example could be just like what you said, can I pay for this personal expense, even though, you know, it's as part of a fundraising trip? Generally, if there's a true fundraising purpose, the answer is yes. But sometimes clients want to be more conservative and they'll pay for it out of their own pocket. So I can't really give you a ton of examples. I think generally in my experience, when people come to lawyers and they ask for help setting up a 501c4, they want to do good with it. And, they try their best to do that.
Okay. So let's say there is a trip in the Bahamas, and while I'm in the Bahamas, they're also going to talk to me about environmental policy. Could I use a 501c4 to pay for that trip and just kind of justify, well, I'm there to discuss a policy issue, to be a part of a larger policymaking conversation?
I mean, I really think it depends on the facts and circumstances that you're getting down to. If there's some sort of environmental policy forum down in the Bahamas and there's a legitimate purpose for someone to attend that forum as an expert or a subject matter expert on that issue, or maybe someone who has the ability to make policy to learn about that, it's possible that that could be covered by a 501c4. I haven't seen a ton of examples where those kinds of retreats are happening in the Bahamas, but it is possible.
Who is typically the enforcement arm for a 501c4? Does the IRS check these? And to what extent have you seen state or local authorities look into these accounts?
Yep, that's a great question. So the IRS obviously has jurisdiction over the taxation of a 501c4. 501c4s have to file a tax return, just like the three of us have to file a tax return. Their tax returns, if their fiscal year is ending on December 31st, their tax returns due May 15th. And the IRS is going to look at that tax return. They have the ability to audit it, and they also have the ability to impose taxes. There's certain transactions that they deem to not qualify as tax exempt, for example, an excess benefit transaction. Separately, you asked about different states and local agencies that are able to sort of enforce laws against them. I think a number of states, I want to say around 25, have what's called charitable solicitation registration requirements for 501c4s. Typically, when you think of charitable solicitation registration, you're thinking of a 501c3, but a number of states also require it for 501c4s. And this basically means if you're soliciting money, and it varies by state, but if you're soliciting money in that state for the 501c4, you have to register with the state and file various documents with them.
So the IRS is checking these forms to make sure that you're not blowing this money on vacations and a trip to Rome and that kind of thing. The IRS would flag that if you were trying to get away with that.
You know, I've seen the IRS audit clients. It's typically sporadic. I don't see a ton of audits, honestly, with 501c4s, but I have had a few clients be audited by the IRS, and sometimes they find things, sometimes they don't. So it just depends.
How would you describe the IRS's capacity right now? Do they have the efficient workforce to be doing appropriate audits?
I probably can't speak to their auditing department, but I do have to call the exempt organizations line pretty frequently. And sometimes you have to wait for hours to get a call back or just sit on hold. So they do seem to be stretched a little thin right now within the exempt organizations department.
I wanted to ask you also, Jessica, about 527s. What is a 527?
Yeah, so a 527, that's actually a section of the tax code, and it can refer to a number of different types of political organizations. So Gretchen Whitmer for governor is a 527. Donald Trump for president is a 527. A super PAC is a 527. The Michigan Republican Party is a 527. So that's just a section of the tax code that refers to political organizations.
So it's more of an umbrella term. So like a super PAC and any hard money account could be described as a 527.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. And then how are those different from a 501c4?
So 527s are different from a 501c4 in a number of ways. First of all, C4, like I talked about earlier, their primary purpose has to be social welfare. They can only have a limited amount of political activity. 527s can have unlimited amounts of political activity. I think those are the primary differences, as well as 501c4's donors are not disclosed, whereas a super PAC, a candidate committee, any type of 527 organization, their donors will be disclosed.
And then just to follow up, now the donors to a 501c4, we can't see them as members of the public, but does the IRS see them?
So the IRS used to require 501c4s to report their donors on their Form 990 on Schedule B. They no longer require that. There was a court case called IRS versus Bullock a few years ago where that requirement was struck down. So now the only thing that's reported on the 990 for a C4 is the date of the donation and the amount of the donation. The donor's name is not reported.
But through an audit, can they get the name of the donor?
Through an IRS audit?
Yeah.
It's possible.
You know, I kind of want to go back to what you were mentioning earlier, how I believe you said 25 states have a requirement where you must register that 501c4 within the state. And how did you just describe it? That you were, is this the person who is the main head of the 501c4? Who's that person responsible for the registration?
So it depends on the state. Every state is different. It's required that the individual who's actually soliciting the funds for the C4, so the fundraiser, do the registration. Some states require the organization be registered. Some states require both.
Okay. And Michigan is not one of those states, correct?
I do not believe so. I believe Michigan only requires charitable solicitation registration for 501c3s.
So when you kind of think of that solicitation process that we're now discussing, I mean, what are the pros and cons? Does a state actually gain some additional protections through having that?
That's a good question. I think it depends on the state laws and what they require to be disclosed. So different states have different disclosure requirements. I think that anything that the state would be able to get and put on their website, you or I could just request from the entity. So the IRS requires that 501c4s make their annual tax returns and then their 1024 application, which is their application for exemption, available to the public. So if you or I requested an organization's tax return or 1024 application, they would have to provide it to us within 30 days.
One of the bills that is being discussed in the state of Michigan is a disclosure requiring people who have connections to 501c4s, politicians now or elected officials who have connections to 501c4s, disclose that they have those. Are you aware of other states that require something along those lines?
You know, I am not aware of other states that require something along those lines. And I think part of the reason is typically when you think of a 501c4, so 501c4s are able, like a super PAC, to accept what's called soft money. So contributions in unlimited amounts from different types of sources. So it could be individuals, it could be corporations. A lot of states have limitations on what candidates can solicit. So for example, federal candidates cannot solicit funds from corporations and they cannot solicit funds in excess of the federal contribution limit. So typically, 501c4s like super PACs are independent from the candidates or the office holders who they might support.
So would there be an issue if the state of Michigan, for example, as we're looking at that particular bill, do you see some issues if we were to try and require that? Because I don't know, because the federal filings might not allow it?
It's not that they wouldn't allow it. I just think it would be somewhat unusual for a candidate or an office holder to say that they're affiliated with an entity, because it's just unusual for a candidate to be affiliated with a C4 like this if they're supporting that candidate. Usually it's done independently because, again, the C4 can accept soft dollars, whereas the candidate generally cannot, and they can't solicit them either.
Yeah, that's a good point. So in the case of Lee Chatfield, the 501c4 in question is called the Peninsula Fund, but his name isn't necessarily attached to the Peninsula Fund. We just know that it is his 501c4. So how do you disclose that you're involved in an entity when your name isn't on the paperwork?
That's a good question. I mean, there may not be any sort of tangible way that he is involved. Like, he, as long as he's not on paper, there could be an argument that he is not necessarily associated with that entity.
And that's the problem with requiring a disclosure. How do you disclose that you're a part of something if you're not really on the paperwork and not technically or legally involved in the 501c4?
That could be the scenario.
Okay.
The Attorney General here in Michigan, this investigation started off as an investigation into sexual assault allegations against Lee Chatfield. And then it evolved into this investigation into dark money and misuses of these accounts. And that kind of brings me to a question for you is, how rare is it that a state attorney general office makes charges against someone involving a 501c4? Is this kind of a rare phenomenon that we're witnessing here?
Yeah, you know, I think it's relatively uncommon. We've seen two major cases in the last few years, Lee Chatfield, which you mentioned, in Michigan, and then Larry Householder in Ohio a few years ago. You know, the Supreme Court has said, going back to the 1960s, that these types of organizations have privacy rights. And I think it's relatively uncommon for this type of investigation to occur.
What happened with Householder?
There was a 501c4 that supported him. And it was alleged, and I think ultimately there was a guilty plea that C4 had been funneling money improperly to individuals to support a specific project in Ohio.
Oh, and his, it was more bribery, wasn't it? As opposed to just blowing it on friends and family.
Yep, correct.
Yeah, okay. And then he ended up getting sentenced to 20 years in prison. Millions. Now I'm looking at the press release, $60 million in bribes. So in that case, a lot more money than what we're talking about here with Chatfield.
And so were you essentially saying that there is a constitutional reason why states are so limited and constrained in their capacity to investigate 501c4s?
The Constitution, specifically the First Amendment, puts up a roadblock. Supreme Court has underscored in numerous times, like I said, starting in 1960 with NAACP versus Alabama, and as recently as a couple years ago with the Americans for Prosperity case out in California. In my experience, these organizations are generally set up and operated to do good work, to promote social welfare. But I think just like any form of entity, a business, a government agency, or a nonprofit, there's always certain individuals who may, you know, use them for an improper purpose.
When you think about the Lee Chatfield case that's ongoing right now, when you think about the case over in Ohio that you just mentioned, do you think the floodgates are about to be opened right now with states that are hungry and determined to be able to investigate these and to change the game?
I don't necessarily think that's the case, because I don't think that there's a lot of entities out there that have these types of issues. Like I said, in my experience, whenever clients come to me and they want to set these groups up, they really want to do it for a good cause and a good reason, and they want to do it correctly, which is why they've come to us for legal counsel, and we help them stay compliant with the law.
I have a final question before we say farewell. So let's say that we are doing a 501c4 class for beginners. I almost wanted to use the term dummies, like a little class for dummies, but beginners. So, I mean, what would you say is the line where dark uses of money become illegal uses of money? How do you summarize that line to the people you're working with?
Like I said in the beginning, as 501c4 is a social welfare organization. So when you set it up, it needs to be organized and operated for the primary purpose of promoting social welfare. And so if it's not doing that, it's also allowed to engage in some political activity. But if it's not doing that, then you really should be taking a look at what it is doing. And in my experience, most of these organizations do really good work. And I hope to see that continue.
No, thank you so much, everybody. That is Jessica Bartlett of the Political Law Practice Group within Dickinson Wright's Washington, D.C. office. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your week to speak with us on the MERS Monday podcast. Joining us for today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast is Brittany Affelter-Kane, the Executive Director of the University Research Corridor, or the URC, in Michigan. The University Research Corridor is an alliance between Michigan's three major research institutions, which consist of Michigan State University, the University of Michigan, and Wayne State University. Now, according to some analysis that was released fairly recently on April 17th, the federally backed and non-federally backed funded research being conducted at these three universities generated more than $1.1 billion, billion for B, in spending on research-related goods and services in Michigan alone during fiscal year 2019 through fiscal year 2022. In Wayne County specifically, purchases from vendors by these URC colleges resulted in more than $436.1 million in research spending. As for what the state gets back from these institutions, the URC has an economic impact report calculating that every single dollar the state government has poured into these universities, $22 has been returned to the economy. For students who remained in Michigan following graduation from a URC university, they earn an average of $69,700 annually in industries related to education, healthcare, and information technology. First off, Brittany, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Samantha.
I know that you are joining us after some Traverse City, Northern Michigan birthday shenanigans. So I appreciate you making room in your schedule to talk about this.
Thank you. It was pure Michigan up north this weekend. Very beautiful.
Incredible. So obviously we just talked about what the URC has described as a series of analysis on the economic effects and workforce opportunities affiliated with the research being conducted at these three universities. My question for you to get this conversation started is, what exactly was the point?
The point of the URC being created?
Of the research, the economic impact analysis.
Gotcha. Okay. I want to clarify a couple things because I know it can be a little confusing. We have traditionally measured our net economic impact over everything we do, from research to education to operations, the number of people we employ, our alumni living in the state, and student spend, the whole gamut, right? What is that impact? And we do that study about every other year. We started it in 2007. Anderson Economic Group does it. And I know you cited some of the metrics at the beginning. What does the state get back for that? What's the benefit of these institutions? The answering the question of, but for these institutions, how does Michigan's economy benefit? And so we do that to keep ourselves somewhat accountable, but also to really expand on how these institutions are assets. The more recent one that you cited really tracked specifically the research. And so it's a very detailed analysis of looking at all the money we bring in to the state from federal sources, other sources, private sources, industry, you name it. We just lump into sponsored research. What does that do for our universities? How are we spending that money when it comes in? And so a lot of services and products are purchased in order to do it. Sometimes you can only source it from some unique special place in the world, right? But a lot of the time, we can source those products and services right here in Michigan. And let me focus a little more on the service part, because this shows, why do this kind of analysis? It shows how we are all interconnected to the research enterprise of these research-intensive institutions in the state. We do 90% of all the academic R&D conducted in the state. The state is a top 10 state for academic R&D conducted, and that's largely because we have these three URC institutions. But how do other places benefit? So we partner with, for instance, a number of different universities across the state who have very specialized researchers or students or some kind of niche research area. And so by partnering with them, contracting connecting with them, they contribute to the overall research grant. And I think that's really important to say, like, hey, how much of the money we're bringing in goes to an Oakland University or a Michigan Tech, or, you know, in partnership to do this research together. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, if I'm a legislator in, say, the Thumb, where there's not an obvious URC campus, how do I know that my constituents have some sort of benefit from these institutions? And in a lot of ways, this very detailed analysis helps answer that question.
What is some research that's going on right now that you find very fascinating or unique?
Well, it's take a pick. Sometimes it's a little overwhelming, and it's my job to know all the interesting things that we're doing. And if anyone's ever interested, we keep a daily stream of research, interesting research projects our institutions are engaged in through our social media channels. But specifically, I think relative to our top industries, we're doing a lot of work in artificial intelligence, right? From not just the technology itself, but how do we then harness this new technology to conduct research in other areas, whether that be in sustainability or automotive or what have you, right? I think a lot of the work that our researchers at our institutions are doing around clean energy, as well as blue economy, which I refer to as anything water related. We are the Great Lakes State. Things from how are microplastics being measured in our waterways, and does that have an impact on human health, for instance? That's one example. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, Samantha, but those are just the tip of the iceberg of what we're experiencing at our institutions.
I mean, totally fine if you can't give an exact number, but how many research projects do you think could be going on within one given week here in Michigan, just through the URC alone?
Oh my gosh. That is a great question. I should come up with some estimate for that, but I don't know it. I can tell you, we do $2.6 billion in academic R&D a year, which makes up 90% of the total academic R&D in the state and 91% of all the academic R&D in the state that's federally funded.
Although the URC is more zoomed in on research, what do you think could be done for Michigan to fully utilize these universities as an economic development tool? Would that be a huge part of the conversation in Lansing right now?
It's a great question. And I would say, I think a better concentration of resources that really help move the innovations that come out of this research from our labs to the marketplace where it can be used, it can make its improvements and help our industries be more competitive. And, you know, that's just a long-term proposition. It requires a lot of investment. We have seen some really promising programs that have been in place in partnership with the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, projects like MTRAC, which basically there are hubs at different institutions across the state of Michigan, including MI3 and Michigan Tech. And they're focused on a specific industry, and they're able to fast track essentially innovations in key sectors, whether that is automotive or life sciences or advanced materials, quickly and out, commercialize it out into the market. I think those are the things. They're hard to do. They take a long time. They're somewhat high risk. I mean, anytime you're starting with new innovations and trying to commercialize that, there's some risk involved. But we are seeing some of our competitors, other states, doing it really well. And we need to rededicate ourselves to, as a state, to really investing in that.
Obviously, right now in the legislature, there is bills dealing with research and development tax credits that are now waiting concurrence approval in the House. And a part of that is allowing a corporation to get a bonus tax credit if it's utilizing one of these universities to conduct its research and development. Is that something that the URC was an official supporter of?
So yes. I mean, anything that helps connect, incentivizes better coordination with our industry partners, with working with our universities in the research space, is very helpful on multiple fronts. It's useful for the company, and it's useful for the university and for the students who are engaged in those projects. We do see more industry-sponsored research in other states, it tends to be in higher ed, something that private institutions do very well. We are public serving institutions, and so it can just take us, there's a few more hoops, right? But as public serving institutions, we think it's very important to make sure we are partnering with industry and coordinating our efforts. So this R&D tax credit, which is really nice in that they have two sections, one for large companies and one for smaller companies, to make sure that they all have a chance to do this and to get some and benefit from working with our institutions.
How many more industry representatives do you imagine coming to universities seeking research and development opportunities if this bill were to be signed into law?
Well, we hope there would be more, that they would be incentivized to work with universities. Michigan is, as I mentioned before, a top 10 state for academic R&D. We are also a top 10 state for industry R&D, but we're not a top 10 state for industry-sponsored academic R&D. So, you know, one way to track that over time, if this tax credit seems to be another piece that helps foster this kind of work together, we would expect to see some parity there, that we would end up in the top 10.
There's just not a lot of collaboration going on right now between
there is a lot of collaboration, but not necessarily at the level you might expect, given how much academic R&D and industry R&D that's going on in the state.
So what does that mean? Not the level that you would expect. So what is it in reality?
So what we're finding, if you are a top 10 state for both types of research, but you're not seeing that same ranking, that same level for industry-sponsored R&D like you do from other top 10 states, that's an indicator that we could be doing a better job. And the reason to do that and to track it is because it is one really important way to make sure that research is being done that is directly impacting companies in our state. It's a way to make sure that the innovation is getting out into the space to help our companies grow and be more competitive. And we want to make sure we're fully a part of realizing that as much as we can.
What is something Michigan does particularly well when it on the policy front when it comes to research and development in the university setting?
So I think one of the things that we're doing really well, I mentioned those MTRAC programs. That very much is a program that is enviable at many other states. They wish they had something quite like that. So I would say that's one example, fast tracking innovation right to our companies in the state and to our economy. Other areas we're doing really well, we are partnering very well with economic development. We are making sure we are providing the kind of analyses that are helpful for them to pitch the state, where these institutions are front and center as assets for both business attraction and growth in the state. So I think one area where we could do a better job, it's been improving over the last couple of years, but we could be doing even better, is by increasing appropriations to higher education. We saw about a 20-some year decline for a long time, and it only recently has been going up. One area in particular that I think helps offset some of that and makes it much more affordable. We, for a long time in the state, we were the worst when it came to need-based financial aid, state-funded need-based financial aid. And over the last year, implementing the Michigan Achievement Scholarship, that I think has been a game changer. And it is making sure that every Michigander who wants to go to one of our public institutions can do so. And so obviously time will tell, and give a few years to see what the impact of that is. But I think it is very promising.
Do you also, and this is going to be a bit of a curveball question, but I know that it's kind of part of the conversation in higher ed policy right now, as certain elected leaders look toward making community college more universal access to community college. I mean, is that something that the URC is concerned about, that could redirect students who would have gone to a URC university to instead go to community college without exploring some of those research opportunities they could access as an undergrad?
Yeah, that's like the big question right now, right? I think, first of all, I want to always be careful because I am not a lobbyist. We do research at the URC to help our lobbyists at the institutions, of course, in making that case. We are always advocating, but at the core, we are advocating we need to have more Michiganders with a higher and post-secondary degree. From my own experience in higher ed and what we see, I think there are so many more people who could find their way, should find their way, should be able to find their way to college. And whether that's a 2-year or a 4-year, we're not serving everyone as well as we could or should. And so I don't think necessarily that somebody who would be impacted by a free 2 years is taking someone away from one of our institutions. If anything, they probably weren't going to go at all. That's what we're really hoping to see, is that somebody who wouldn't be going at all would go. Furthermore, if they do, that's an added number of people getting that 2 year, getting those first 2 years done for, and then being able to transfer into one of our institutions. I think that would be a win for the state.
And again, totally, no, you are not a lobbyist. Just another clarification. But I mean, what are some things that you would want to see possibly in terms of relief for the students at these URC colleges who may raise concern that they're having trouble affording housing in that university community, that may feel like they're getting underpaid for the research that they're conducting? What are your thoughts on that?
So there's a lot going on, and I am certainly not an expert on higher education finance. But what we do know in the field, and we have been talking about for decades, is declines in state appropriations for public institutions like mine. And that takes a toll somewhere. Universities have to make it up somewhere. And unfortunately, if you look at what the ratio is between what families pay or students pay to get a college education, what their share of the total tuition is today versus what the state funds and subsidizes essentially today versus 30 years ago, it has flip-flopped. And so when we as citizens, as a state, we decide not to properly fund our public institutions, someone has to pay. And at this point, we've shifted the burden of the cost of a college education to students and their families. And so one area we could really do a better job is in making sure we are properly funding our institutions.
So would you say your biggest fear is how students' potential financial insecurity could impact the larger mission of the URC and its capacity to generate what it would say is meaningful research?
Correct. Correct. You know, we talked last time, and we have half of our 1.5 million living alumni live in Michigan. And that's people across the career and life spectrum, right? That's a lot of folks, and they certainly make a contribution to the state in their communities and to the economy. To make sure we continue to attract our own grads to the state and to making their contributions here, we need to make sure that they can finish, right? All of our institutions are doing really interesting work, again, with some help from the state and the Michigan Achievement Scholarship, among other programs, to help students who are financially challenged get from one semester to the next, right? They're providing a number of resources for these gaps, because it can actually depress graduation rates. It will, if you can't afford it, you can't stay in and finish and get that degree. And so whatever support structures, and by the way, it's not always financial. A lot of the time it is through very supportive counseling or advisors is what I really want to call them. Very, very helpful advisors and programs that support students. I will be honest with you. I was a Pell recipient when I went to college. I am the first in my family to go to college. We just didn't have the resources, and I didn't know the path exactly. I'd learned as fast as I could from other people. But at the end of the day, what was so important, while the financial aid was critical, I wouldn't have finished but for all of the support structures at my college that helped advise me, kept up with me. When I, as a first gen, and we do see this in the research, it's not that they make the decision, it's binary, you go, you don't go to college. It's a zillion decisions when you're in college to decide, can I stay here? Can I really do this? There are just so many barriers along the way, and having the right support structures and people to catch kids like me is really important. And that's how they persist. They get the degree and they pay it forward.
Now we are a little bit over time. I think my final question for you, what do you think the state is still continuing to learn when it comes to research universities?
Their value to them, their value to their communities. The better we can translate what seems out of sight, out of mind, and frankly complex into messages that resonate with people, making those connections to the work that we're doing at our institutions, how it impacts their lives for the better, that's how we get people to better understand the value proposition of these institutions. We change lives. I mean, I know that seems, you know, big, but it's true. We change lives.
Everybody, that is Brittany Affelter-King, the Executive Director of the University Research Corridor, or the URC in Michigan. Brittany, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Conclude today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. MERS editor Kaya Malin and I spoke with Mike Alamo, the Director of Environmental and Energy Affairs of the Michigan Chamber of Commerce. He spoke with us about his organization's concerns about how last month the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, under the Joe Biden White House, announced final rules regulating countrywide pollution standards for cars and trucks from the model years of 2027 through 2032. It's been reported that the modified rules could cut tailpipe emissions in nearly half by 2055. Mike makes the case, however, that such regulations make bold assumptions about the future market, ramp up penalties against folks in the auto industry, and can constrain consumer choice. Here's the interview, which we edited for the sake of time. So, Mike, one of the reasons why we have you on the podcast here today is to talk about the Corporate Average Fuel Economy Standards, CAFE, which when you were talking about them, I got a little bit confused. I thought it was talking about cafes that sell coffees and donuts.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So basically, I have the U.S. Department of Transportation website right in front of me. Okay. So basically, it requires an industry-wide fleet average of approximately 49 miles per gallon for passenger cars and light trucks in model year 2026, which the U.S. Department of Transportation says would be the strongest cost savings and fuel efficiency standards to date. And then that increases fuel efficiency by 8% annually for model years 2024 through 2025 and 10% annually for model year 2026. So from the Michigan Chamber of Commerce perspective, what exactly does that mean? And what are the obstacles that your organization is zooming in on?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on today. This is an important issue that I think people maybe aren't quite, you know, aware of, at least in terms of how it could impact them directly as consumers, but also impact Michiganders writ large because of our strong automotive heritage and manufacturing base. So as you point out, Sam, you know, this is a historic increase in the CAFE standards to automakers' fleet efficiencies. The CAFE standards have been around since the 70s. They've been around right around the time that the Clean Air Act was created. And the idea was that we should be ensuring that public health is a priority and making sure air quality is a priority. And so part of that means ensuring that tailpipe emissions are working towards cleaner efficiency standards so that, you know, we're cleaning up kind of the ambient air that folks are breathing in. That's a good thing. And we have seen through that and other regulations and other and frankly market innovations that our air quality has significantly improved over the last several decades. 80% for a number of the pollutants that EPA regulates for, 80% decrease in, you know, the ambient air that we breathe in. And so that's a good thing. What we've seen over the years typically is that the CAFE standards generally keep up with innovation to market, meaning that through a robust stakeholder process, regulators work with automakers and other industry groups and stakeholders to understand what is kind of the state of the art when it comes to technology development and what can be done at scale, right? Importantly, at scale to achieve greater efficiency standards and help continue to clean up our air. With this rule set, we're seeing a significant leapfrog beyond what automakers are able to innovate around. And so that's fundamentally where we start to have concerns.
I think my question is that aren't we already on the path toward these historic fuel efficiency highs? So why the concern with it just getting put in stone via a regulation or standard?
I should say, you know, first, fundamentally, the chamber's position is that electrifying our transportation sector is happening. And that's a good thing. And we should support, you know, the electrification of our sector. You're right about the fact that we are on the path to doing so. I think it really just comes down to how long that path is, right? And so that's the challenge that we have is when you try to artificially create a shorter pathway towards technologies like all electric vehicles or things of that nature coming to market and making it so that you're restricting choice because those are the only technologies that would qualify under these fuel efficiency standards. That's when you start to see significant stranded costs, right? Costs that go into just meeting the standard rather than innovating and keeping in mind all of the many things that consumers want, like safety, like vehicle size, like vehicle performance, all of these things. If you're focusing solely on meeting this standard, that leads to significant increases to costs and could lead to a significant decrease in consumer choice, which we're also very, very concerned about as well. So electrification is happening. EVs are the future. That's a good thing. But let's make sure we're doing so in a way that is market driven so that consumers and American taxpayers aren't left holding the bag. And I will say there were some fundamental assumptions that went around this new standard that I think are flawed and should be importantly called out. One is that the IRA is kind of going to fix all this for domestic manufacturers. The IRA, with all of its tax credits and subsidizations, is going to be able to ensure that domestic automakers are able to acquire and produce all of the materials and technologies needed to produce battery electric vehicles at the pace they need to meet this new CAFE standard. That's simply yet to be seen. I mean, it's possible, but I think, as we know, the federal government moves slow. And so we're seeing the slow churning of the federal government work towards developing rules on how IRA dollars will be spent and rules around how tax credits qualify and all of those things. And all the while, you know, we're trying to ensure that we're increasing our production capacity in America for battery electric vehicles so that we're not getting all these materials from countries like China or other places that are significantly further ahead in their production capacity. The other fundamental piece of this is that we're assuming certain levels of electric vehicle adoption. And so why does this really matter? We're not necessarily seeing that. Again, we could, but the future is uncertain as to exactly what that adoption rate looks like. And so that's one of those things. Consumers want options. They don't maybe want to go from a diesel truck or gasoline powered truck to a full battery electric vehicle. Maybe they want a hybrid. Maybe they want to try plug-in hybrid as some of these, you know, some other, you know, options before they go fully into electric vehicles.
I am a little bit confused. What is the difference between fuel efficient and EV? Because when I look at this press release, I see fuel efficient, but I don't see EV.
That's right. Yeah, no, because it looks just at the average fuel efficiency of a fleet of vehicles by class. And so what you're talking about is as you increase the efficiency to this 57, for example, MPG by 2032, you're looking at two things. One, there is a gas equivalent to EVs, right? Where they look at, to put it in layman's terms, like a carbon footprint associated with an electric vehicle, the carbon footprint associated with fueling that vehicle with electrons, all of those things, and they create an MPG equivalent, right? It's obviously not using gas, so you have to kind of use a calculation that tries to create an equivalency standard. And then you also have the reality that the innovations to internal combustion engines simply won't be able to keep up with that efficiency. And so automakers won't want to offer those options or sell those options because they would be penalized for doing so.
Mike, is our air cleaner today than it was 10 years ago?
Significantly. And I'd be happy to follow up with hard data on that. But when you're looking at the 12 contaminants or pollutants that the EPA regulates under the National Air Ambient Air Quality Standard, or you're looking at tailpipe emissions and the CAFE standards, we're seeing double-digit benefits, decreases in those pollutants in our national air. That's a good thing. And we are quickly approaching an arena in which there's only so much to do around increasing regulations on businesses, because some of these pollutants are coming from other sources like wildfires or like simply traffic congestion. There's not a whole lot we can do around that. But that's increasingly a slice of the pie as to where those pollutants are coming from.
Why is our air cleaner? Is it because of government regulations? Is it because of corporate innovation? What do you think?
I think it's both. I think that is actually the kind of the nexus of why we have concerns with where we are at today around some of these standards, because traditionally, government has worked with industry leaders to understand where regulations can help provide a nudge to innovation and, you know, increasing air quality benefits. But not so far in that industry can't comply, or industry is penalized, or simply can't exist because of regulatory compliance.
How much do you follow what's happening internationally, and how is that going in other countries? Let's say China and India are often referenced as being the world's major polluters. Do you follow that much at all? And can you give us some insight on how bad or overblown that might be?
Sure. I think there are some folks that maybe make it the issue as opposed to a piece of the issue. But it is an important consideration for folks to think about when they're looking at how do we increase American regulations to address climate change, because it's not just America that's a part of this puzzle, right? We are all important players in this. Certainly America being a global leader, economic leader, you know, does contribute a significant amount, but so do other countries like India and China and folks of that nature that do not have the same regulatory framework, particularly around energy production. And so that's a fundamental piece of how we look at reducing air emissions, is looking at where does our energy come from and how is it produced? And we know that in China and in India and other countries, they're still heavily reliant on coal and other dirtier, less efficient fuel types. And frankly, that issue is becoming, I think, greater acknowledged in America, as we've seen the rise of electric vehicles or certainly the rise of semiconductor production capacity. When we're looking at where these have come traditionally, right, China supplies 85 to 90% of the solar panels that we need for solar energy. They are contributing similarly to electric vehicle materials. These are largely coming from a grid in China that's very dirty. And so it's also something that I think the federal government is trying to address through things like the IRA. That's a good thing. We, you know, we should be onshoring our production capacity for this next generation of clean energy technologies, whether it's transportation or grid, whatever. But I think we need to be mindful of how long that takes, right? We're kind of going back to a World War II era style of rebuilding a manufacturing capacity, and that takes time.
So what are kind of some of the biggest concerns that you're hearing from your members when it comes to the era that we're in with federal EPA regulations?
Mm-hmm. Certainly spoke to the concerns around CAFE standards and stranded costs associated with the production of those vehicles, but then also on the backs of consumers. And we are seeing, you know, some estimates say that consumers, while they might save money on the one end from having a more fuel efficient vehicle, they're probably paying significantly more upfront because of the cost around compliance to getting that vehicle to market. But the other areas generally revolve around another area of air quality regulation for the EPA, which is the National Ambient Air Quality Standard. So as I mentioned earlier, there are 12 different contaminants that the EPA regulates in the NAAQS regulatory regime. And we've seen significant restrictions in those standards over the last years, some of which have affected Michigan disproportionately. So recently, we went through a regulatory process around ozone. And, you know, as a lot of people know, ozone is this really nasty pollutant that comes from combusting petrochemicals and things of that nature, and that interacting with the air and sunlight and creating ozone. And we have seen significant improvements in the air quality around ozone, and that's the really good thing. What we saw largely because of wildfires in Canada was some days in which the monitors, the air quality monitors in Southeast Michigan, raised some red flags. And for a while, the EPA had determined Southeast Michigan was in non-attainment for ozone. Ultimately, the chamber, through its advocacy, but also Eagle, working with the EPA to look at the data and really determine what data should be used for determining attainment, they decided that Southeast Michigan was in fact in attainment, and so no further action needed to be taken on that front. There's still a lot of work that needs to be done and continue to make sure that we stay out of attainment, but that generally speaking, we were able to avoid what would be significant increases in regulation if we were not in attainment. And that means things like manufacturers maybe having to cycle off for certain days of the year, or looking at having to make increases in scrubbers or other types of air filtration systems and things of that nature, which could be an incredible expense to manufacturers. So that's generally a good thing. Now, the Sierra Club did sue the EPA over that ruling, and so we are now engaged in that lawsuit to make sure that Southeast Michigan remains in attainment.
Mike, I've got one more question here. I've heard it said that the manufacturing of these electric car batteries are as environmentally harmful as just burning pure gasoline. Is that accurate?
I don't believe so. I think, you know, we've seen some numbers. We've seen some estimates like the ones that you're speaking to, Kyle. But I've seen other estimates that show that is not the case. And a lot of it does come down to the fact that we have made incredible strides to cleaning up our grid. And so as we've moved towards natural gas as a major production source of electricity, as we move towards more renewables, as we move away from coal, all of these things mean that our electrons are cleaner in Michigan than they have been ever before. And so as you're charging up your vehicle, that means that there's a lower carbon footprint associated with it. So yeah, no, I believe that electric vehicles are good for the environment. I think that if you're looking at the carbon life cycle of these vehicles, there's a net benefit there. And so Chamber's all in on supporting the increase in electric vehicles. And so it really comes down to how we do so in a way that supports our automakers and doesn't penalize them, and also supports our consumers.
Why did Sierra Club sue the EPA?
Sierra Club sued the EPA over the determination that Southeast Michigan was in fact under attainment or was in fact compliant with the ozone ambient air quality standard. Basically, they took issue with how the EPA and Eagle reviewed the data. Ultimately, EPA and Eagle determined that some of these data points where the ozone was a little bit higher on certain days of the year was not due to your traditional sources like manufacturers, like tailpipe emissions, but was in fact from the Canadian wildfires. And so we shouldn't count those days. And so if you don't count those days, it was found that that region was found in compliance, which is exactly what the Clean Air Act is structured to do. It's to make sure that we're achieving compliance with these standards in a way that is within our control, right? That was something where they said, yeah, this makes sense. Sierra Club disagrees. And so the issue is being litigated.
I mean, we talked about so many different things today, but how would you ultimately summarize, or do I dare say dumb down to the everyday consumer in Michigan, what this all means for them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, I think what the average Michigan consumer needs to realize is that these regulations do impact them. They lead to increases in costs to some of the major employers in our state. Michigan is home to a really phenomenal supply chain of automotive and industrial manufacturers, and that's a good thing, and we should support them. But with these increasing regulations that don't properly match innovation and don't properly match technological development, that will lead to these increased costs ultimately being passed on to consumers. Or it could, you know, lead to manufacturers having to make some tough decisions about where they invest and maybe making these investments out of the state. So that could lead to a loss of jobs, that could lead to loss of economic development, and we don't want that either. And so it is one of those things that it's this big kind of diffuse thing happening over in Washington, D.C., but it really could have a very tangible impact on the average Michigander.
Well, thank you so much, Mike. I really appreciate the insights.
Yeah. Thanks so much, guys.
And that is going to do it for today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. I would like to thank our several guests for this week, including legal professional Jessica Bartlett of the Dickinson Rights Washington, D.C. office and the general counsel of the 2023 Ron DeSantis for President campaign. Moreover, I would like to thank Executive Director Brittany Affelter Kane of the University Research Corridor, who spoke with us on Sunday evening, as well as Director Mike Alamo of the Environmental and Energy Affairs for the Michigan Chamber of Commerce, who spoke with us on Friday morning. Finally, thank you so much to MERS editor Kyle Malin for helping me put today's episode together. And I would like to send a huge thanks to Mark Bayshore of Mark Bayshore Audio out in Okemos, which is responsible for putting this audio together. Until next time, I am your host, Samantha Schreiber.